words on TV, words for clicks, words for comfort, words for peace, words to make the fighting cease, words to tell you.
Welcome to the world of Wordaholics. I'm Giles Brandreth, and this is Wordaholics, the panel show about language that dots its I's, crosses its T's, minds its P's and Q's, while all the time knowing sweet F.A. Joining me are four fellow Wordaholics. This is our weekly meeting. Lloyd Langford, Natalie Haynes, Holly Walsh, and Paul Sinner. Here they are. Before we go any further, I'd like to lightly grill our panelists on their love of language. First, Lloyd Langford. You're a stand-up comedian who performs at venues across the country seemingly every night of the week. What word or words do you find yourself using most often when you're on stage?
A word that I've only just started using in my stand-up is coconut. I've been thinking about the lies they tell us in adverts, and I see a lot of shampoo adverts where they say, this shampoo is really good for your hair because it's full of coconut oil. And I've been thinking, it hasn't really done that well for the coconut.
Joining Lloyd is Natalie Haynes, critic, novelist, classicist, and distinguished supporter of the British Humanist Association. Natalie is such a staunch non-believer. Can you tell us what is your favourite religious word or phrase?
I think that probably comes from Virgil's Aeneid. Dido, the queen of Carthage, is desperately in love with Aeneas, and she's so desperate to find out if he loves him, she gets super superstitious. So she starts, they sacrifice animals, and she peers at the entrails to try and read them, and the priests keep telling her what they think she wants to know. And Virgil says, "Hu, vatum ignari mentes." Alas, the unknowing minds of priests.
Next, let's welcome the writer and comedian Holly Walsh. Now, Holly, before you became a comedian, I understand you were an art historian specialising in the medieval period. What's your favourite word from the Middle Ages?
There's an awesome piece of clothing called a quarterpi. At the end of the sort of 1300s, men's clothing got very sexy, and they used to wear a special sort of doublet, which was specially designed to stop just above the waist, to deliberately show off your package and bum. That was the entire purpose of it. So it was sort of like a medieval posing pouch.
What's this called again?
Quarterpi.
A quarterpi? I might try and get one from time. Let's welcome Paul Sinner, not just a comedian, but also a master of trivia. What do you think is the most trivial word in the world?
I suppose it depends on what you mean by trivial. I sort of take it to mean something that's a great trivia question. My favourite is ones where nobody actually knows where it's come from. One of those is hooligan, and nobody has a clue where it comes from.
So that old story about it being an Irish family, the hooligans,
apparently is completely
wrong.
It's either a family from an 1890s drinking song, or one's particular violent Irish bouncer who also lived in the 1890s. I love the fact that one violent bouncer didn't know that he was going to give his name to a word in the English language. But I love the fact that nobody's got a clue where this complicated word comes from.
I think we've established that you're all very brilliant, so it's time for round one now and our letter of the week. And we're thrilled to be joined by a very exciting young letter this week. Will you please welcome the letter S? And here she comes now, sashing softly down the Wordaholics catwalk. It's the letter S. And it's hard not to admire that sinuous, suspiciously serpentine shape. It's as if she bends her head over shyly, arches her back in the silkiest of fashions, and sensuously sticks out a leg behind her while whispering, "I'm S." She's smart, she's sophisticated, she's seriously sick of my sexist slander. It's the letter S. Please welcome her. Lloyd Langford, I have an S for you. Can you tell me what is the meaning of the expression smothering a parrot?
Is it an instant ban from the zoo?
I'll give you a bit of a clue. It goes down in one.
It's a drink.
It's to do with a drink. It's a Victorian term. One associates it possibly with Paris at the turn of the 20th century.
Is it absinthe?
It is absinthe. You helped him out, but you both get a couple of points there. Smothering a parrot is a Victorian term. It means to down a neat glass of absinthe in one. Like that. And, of course, because absinthe is green, as parrots so often are. Natalie Haynes, you're next to get an S. What is a St. Giles carpet?
It's not the carpet at your house, is it? Is it a carpet? It's not a carpet at all.
It is a carpet, and yet it isn't a carpet. You're quite right. Think of an hourglass, perhaps.
Oh, sand, sand. You throw sand on the street. Why do you do that? That hasn't helped me at all.
Well.
Is it grit? Is it, if it's icy?
Oh, to dry out, when it's been wet? Oh, wait, when it's been wet, to dry up horrible things. Ah, like janitors put sawdust down on vomit in primary schools. It's the equivalent of that.
It is absolutely the equivalent of that. You got there in the end with a little help from Holly, who gets a bonus for her assistance. A St. Giles's carpet is another nugget of Victorian slang, which simply means a light sprinkling of sand, and it gets its name from the sand merchant who operated a stall outside the Church of St. Giles in the Fields in West London. The sand was sold for cleaning kitchen utensils and strewing on the floor to protect the floorboards and to clean up. It's much cheaper and easier to replace than an actual carpet, with the added benefit that, of course, you can make castles. And that's Giles with an I, St. Giles with an I. There's no St. Giles with a Y as yet. Holly, here is your S. What would you be doing if you were to ride on Shanks's mare?
Well, Shanks sounds sort of like meat, like meaty or metal. Like, I always think of a sort of, I guess, when is this from? When is this word from? Like, I know that people call
it. This word first occurred in 1785. That's when it's first used. You need to take a step in the right direction.
Well, where I live in South London. Where I live in South London, people call bikes iron horses. So is Shank's mare like a scooter? Is it a 18th century scooter?
It's lovely. It is an 18th century scooter in a way. It's legs.
Oh.
No, but I mean, you were getting there, so you're going to get a little point of some sort. It's also known as Shanks's pony, Shanks's mare. It's an expression that derives from 18th century Scots. Riding Shanks's mare means to use your own legs, walking, basically. The shank being a term for the lower part of your leg. Is that the lower part?
Something like that. Yeah. I can't really remember anymore. No.
And Shanks's mare is not to be confused with Shanks's nightmare, which is to walk into an exam hall and suddenly realise that you are naked. So a couple of points there, Holly, for a not totally comprehensive answer, but you were moving in the right direction. Finally, Paul, what is the area of expertise of a spermologer?
Well, sperm means what it means, but it also means seed. So, an ology, as Maureen Lipman said, if you're an ology, you're a scientist. So it's somebody who studies seed or sperm.
What do you do when you cast seed, you know?
You disgrace yourself.
When you find
Try.
The when you find the correct answer, pass it on.
Is it a farmer?
Hmm?
A farmer.
A farmer, yes, right. That's the kind of seed. What are you doing? You're spreading. So what is it?
Sowing.
Not sowing, no. Well, sowing, yes, but what are you sowing?
Seeds.
It's like the worst game of charades ever.
Because I'm doing movement here, but I'm showing the mouth moving as well. You're spreading...
Speaking, you're spreading gossip.
Spreading gossip. Well done, Natalie. You got there in the end. A spermologer is a gossip, a rumour monger. We used to use the word in English, but it dates back to ancient Greece. It's even in the Bible, where St. Paul is described by unbelievers as a spermologer. Yeah. A spermologer, it also means, Paul, a picker-up of trivia. So, as a famed quizzer, you're a bit of a spermologer yourself.
I've been called that before, certainly.
Yeah. Actually, when I sit on the one-show sofa sometimes, I ask the guests to fill me in on the latest spermology. And now no one seems to want to sit next to me. Portmanteaus. Portmanteaus are words that are made up from taking two other words and jamming them together. Like the way alcohol and pop make up alcopop, mock and cockney make up mockney, and bisexuality and curiosity make up my usual excuse for all sorts of misdemeanor. This next round is a celebration of these words, and it's called Heads, Shoulders, Portmanteaus.
Portmanteaus.
Isn't this a wonderful program with real production values? Natalie, we're going to start with you. What two words make up the portmanteau chalk? C-H-O-R-K. Chalk.
Yeah, well, if it's an O-R-K, it's almost always fork. I'm going with fork as one of them. So it's got to be a cross between a fork and a chihuahua. cheese fork, the well-known cheese fork to go with your cheese knife. Is it a chopstick? Chopstick and a fork.
It's a chopstick and a fork. Hey! It lasts to get the points. Congratulations. A chalk is a cross between chopsticks and a fork, a training chopsticks that are linked at one end with a fork head. And perfect for those times when you want to eat rice while looking like an idiot. Let's turn to you, Holly. Can you dismantle this portmanteau for us? Geep. G-E-E-P. Geep.
Geep.
We're looking for animals here.
Oh, okay. Oh. Is it a
sheep?
Yeah.
Sheep.
Goat sheep.
And a goat.
It's a goat and a sheep. Yes. Everybody seemed to chip in there. A geep is the offspring of a goat and a sheep. They're genetically different animals with a different number of chromosomes, but they are capable of producing offspring together. Here's one for you, Paul. What two words make up the portmanteau smirting? S-M-I-R-T-I-N-G, smirting.
Well, it's either skirting or flirting, so I'll go with flirting. Something that you do at the same time as flirting that begins with S. M. Smiling and flirting? Smooching and flirting?
Smarmy flirting?
I'm going to help you.
Oh, hang on a second. Smoking and flirting?
It is smoking and flirting. You got there in the end, so you're going to get a couple of points. Term first coined in New York in 2003 as a result of the smoking ban. It's a combination of smoking and flirting. You go outside to smoke, you fall into a conversation with someone, before you know it, you're smirting. Glorious. Think of it. Cupid's arrow fired straight through the lungs. Lloyd, can you break down the portmanteau flexitarian?
I think it's a flexible vegetarian in that they say they're vegetarian, so they're always banging on about quinoa, but as soon as you start cooking bacon...
They 2 points for the correct answer and a bonus for the interesting social observation.
And flexitarians are only vegetarian like 2 days a week or something. That's not vegetarian. That's still a dead chicken. You get that, right? It doesn't know it's Monday.
Natalie and Lloyd, at this stage of the game, you've got 18 points. Paul and Holly, you are just ahead with 20 points. The English language is a wonderful and versatile thing, but it doesn't have all the answers. There are some concepts and situations that other countries have words for, but we don't. Like the Australian word sproic, which means to hold forth like a showman. Clearly, I am a natural-born sproiker. And from now on, I'll ask the panel not to sproic until they're sproken to. So this round is called You Can't Say That, and it's all about words for which there is no direct equivalent in English. Can our panellists guess what they mean? Lloyd Langford, you're first this time. This is a word from Central American Spanish. What do you suppose is a chaquetero?
Is it a hole in your suit? I've got a chaquetero.
Let me give you some options. Is it A, a delicious meaty snack, which is deep fried in lard and then rolled in sugar? B, a man employed to calm down a bull after a bullfight? Or C, is it someone who doesn't know what side they're on? Chacatero.
I've done some bad jobs in my life, but I can't think of anything worse of trying to calm down a bull after a bull. That can't be a thing. And the first one doesn't sound plausible either. I go for the third option.
Is that like a sort of swings both ways? Doesn't know what side they're on. Like, if you are bisexual, are you chuckatero?
Yes, in a sense, if you're not comfortable with it, certainly it could be that, because it's someone who keeps changing sides in an argument.
So I wouldn't describe sex as an argument.
You've clearly not lived in the Brandreth household. So the answer, you got it right, Lloyd. The answer is C. A chacatero is someone who keeps changing sides in an argument. And actually, I think we do have a word for that in Britain. It's liberal democrat. Okay, Holly, here's one for you to ponder. From the Chilean Spanish, what would you be doing if you were to pagar el piso?
I think this is an early 90s expression for dropping your pager in a urinal.
You get a bonus for that vivid definition, but it isn't the right one. I'll give you some alternatives. Would you be A, queuing for the toilet, B, celebrating your new job by splashing out on your friends? You started it, Holly. Or C, swimming along a river against the tide.
I mean, I don't speak Spanish or Chilean version of Spanish, so this is a stab in the dark. I'm going to do the one about peeing on your friends. That sounds... I'm going to say pee on... It's when you get a new job and you just celebrate by just peeing on all your friends.
Splashing out on your friends is what you mean, and that is correct.
Because yay!
Yeah, well done. Give it a round of applause. You get the point. To pagar el piso is to pay for the floor, literally in translation, and it means to treat all of your friends to free drinks, courtesy of the first wage packet from your job. And finally in this round, Paul, from the Manobo language of the Philippines, what is the meaning of the word liput? L-I-P-U-T. Let me give you some alternatives. Is it A, being nice to someone in order to lower their defences before the fatal blow? B, trying not to burp while someone important is in the room? Or C, a really annoying baby? A liput.
Well, from what I know of tribes in the Philippines, I don't think they'd find babies annoying. I think they're unconditionally embraced. And I don't think the burping is a problem, whereas savage killing is probably something that happens from time to time. And so I'm going to make a wild stab in the light in this case, and say it's to lower their defences by being lovely to them before they stab them or slay them or axe them or poison dart them. It's the first one.
You're completely brilliant. You get 2 full points. You thought it through and got the right answer. Well done. Mm. It's A. Liput is to throw someone off guard through a gesture of goodwill so that you then have a chance to kill them. Paul, have a chocolate. Every paradise must have its serpent. Every rose must have its thorn. Every Hampshire must have its Basingstoke. This round is called Words Fail Us, and it's about those words that let the whole of the rest of the beautiful English language down. Those words we simply cannot stand. Paul, what word would you like to dismiss from existence?
My least favourite word is foodie. How pretentious do you have to be to call yourself a foodie just because you eat chinois? We're all foodies.
Chinois is a... silk.
I don't know how it's pronounced.
I think you mean quinoa.
Quinoa. I know, that's the whole point. I have no idea how it's pronounced. I don't care. And do you know why I don't care? It doesn't taste that good. I'll tell you what tastes that good. 10 in the morning, toasted bacon and egg sandwich with fully buttered bread. I'll tell you what tastes amazing before 10:30. I won't advertise the company, but a double sausage and egg McMuffin. That's... just because that's my favourite food doesn't mean I'm not a foodie as well. We all like food. We're all foodies. To label yourself as one above other people is pretentious in the extreme. There, I've said my bit.
Oh, well, we like your bit. We like what you said. What, Lloyd, If you were in charge of the English language, what would you be getting rid of?
I would get rid of a word which is a portmanteau word, which is chillax. I'll tell you why, Giles, because both of the original words, chill and relax, mean exactly the same thing. And when people tell me to chillax, it has the adverse effect in that I get increasingly angry.
Very good. I think it's very good. Chillax, we want that to go. Finally, Natalie, what word has got your goat? Or should I be saying geep? I don't know. What word is it?
I would like to get rid of the word grow when used as a transitive, non-horticultural verb. I do not mind people growing their hair. I do not mind people growing up or growing old. I do not mind people growing sunflowers or rose bushes. People growing businesses can just stop it. People... I will not have it. It is at an end. All the people on The Apprentice going, well, I'm going to grow your business. Shut up, shut up, shut up.
Absolutely. Well, I think you met the challenge there with suitable passion. I congratulate you all. Every year, new words enter the English language and others drop out. Who now remembers such long-forgotten words as sanguinolent, apricity, and MySpace?
Be honest, Charles, do you know what that joke means?
I do. I do. Apricity is a kind of website thing that hasn't sort of fallen in favour in recent years. Oh, yeah, I know that because I goggled it earlier. This week's words come from one of the oldest dictionaries ever produced. It's Robert Cawdrey's Table Alphabetical, published in 1604. And dictionary purists will tell you it's been downhill ever since. Paul Sinner, what, according to this venerable dictionary, was a mulct? M-U-L-C-T.
Very short, very horrible-sounding Anglo-Saxon sort of word, so I'm going to assume it means something particularly vile and horrible, and I'm going to pluck out a random thing. Is it the food that's left on the plate when a dinner guest dies suddenly at dinner?
It isn't, but the negative connotation is such, I'm going to give you a point anyway. I'm going to make things a little easier for you with the multiple choice. Is a mulct a petition, B, a shackle for a horse, or C, a punishment? Remember, the year is 1604.
Well, you said it was something horrible, so I'm going to... I have no idea. Is it some sort of weird execution device or something? Well, it's a punishment.
It is a punishment. You get the full points for that. It is a mulct, is a fine or a punishment. Lloyd Langford, what on earth, according to Cawdrey, is a matrix? Spelt M-A-T-R-I-X-E. In 1604, matrix.
Is it a tapestry featuring a knight called Keanu? Fighting with the Lord of Blacksmiths.
That's very neat, you know, but it isn't the right answer. I'll give you some options. Is a matrix A, the liver, B, the womb, or C, the real world in which we all actually live?
C to me sounds a bit existentialist, and I think matrix connected to matron and femininity. I'll go for womb.
It is B. A matrix is a womb where babies come from. In case anyone out there was still wondering. Natalie, what would you be if you were pistated?
I feel like it should be misquoted by somebody because they're a bit drunk. If it isn't, that's what it should be.
If you were pistated, according to this dictionary, do you think you'd have been A, baked, B, disemboweled, or C, in need of a good lie down?
The last one sounds suspiciously made up, so I veto that. What was the second one?
Disemboweled.
Oh, no, I don't
And the first
that.
One was being baked, something that's baked.
Like bread.
You got there in the end, with a little help, so I'm going to give you 1.5 marks there. And last today is Holly Walsh. This is a verb, Holly. What is to obnubilate?
It's got the word nubile in it, which sounds a bit like nubile, which is sort of an old-fashioned word for a woman who, a lady who is ready for marriage. So is it like obstruct a marriage? Is it sort of an old school word for cock blocking?
Obnubilate, is it A, to make more flexible, B, to make darker, or C, to prepare for marriage?
My marriage theory stands with the last one. Yeah, I'm going to go for that.
You've been fooled.
Can you help?
It's the clouds. I think a new beta cloud.
Well done. Natalie Haynes has got it. It's a
extra
cloud.
Latin.
Well done.
Come on,
extra Latin. Absolutely. And it comes from the Latin obnubilare, meaning to cover with cloud. So it's a very serious matter. And congratulations. You'll get a couple of points there. So well done. And that marks the end of this week's Frantic Philology. Looking at the final scores, we see that in second place, but only just, Natalie and Lloyd, you have 33 points, whereas just ahead are Paul and Holly, this week's winners, with 34.
Yay!
Winners, Paul, Holly, before we go, can you describe your Wordaholics experience in a word, Holly?
I'm going to go and pagar el piso, my success. I'm going to go and pee on my friends. That's how how happy I am about this, to celebrate.
Good. And what about you, Paul?
Well, it's been chillaxing. We've your presenting has really grown this show, and... And in the spirit of portmanteaus, I'm going to stick two words together. It's been very enjoyable. How smooth was that?
Hey, very smooth indeed. It's too late for bonuses, but you deserve them. Over here, what about you two? Natalie?
I think I'm going to go with hooliganised, so cruelly mistreated, do I feel. And also, I like the fact that I didn't know I had a derivation, or no derivation that people knew.
Lloyd Langford, you get the last word.
Quinoa.
So that's all from this week's Wordaholics. Will you please thank once again our splendid guests, Lloyd Langford, Natalie Haynes, Holly Walsh and Paul Sinner. Until next time, goodbye. You have been listening to Wordaholics, chaired by me, Giles Brandreth. It's written by John Hunter and James Kettle. The producer is Claire Jones.